I feel like I'm watching a train wreck in slow motion. I can't do reality TV for that reason. I feel like I'm watching a train wreck. Like, anything that's, like, reality TV based, I can't do it. It physically makes me uncomfortable. So, yeah. Anyway. Thank you.
I was going to say, I like that shirt, Mike.
Do you like my white socks and my dress pants?
Yep.
You like that?
Yeah.
Only me can pull that off. I got downstairs and realized, you know what? No, I'm not actually going to go back upstairs and find matching socks. Don't care. They're clean. Huh? Yeah, but I think the proper.
You should just roll with it.
You know what? I didn't ask the wife, so. All right, enough of critiquing my dress. It's bad enough as it is, man. I'm just trying to hang on the back of the fashion train. Let's be honest. I'm not trying to set any trends. I'm just trying not to fall off completely.
Colorblind is the best.
Proverbs 16, verses 1 through 3. Let's do these real quick. We're done with our conflict. Or I am, so we are as well. So I gave you what I had. So let's chat through, just maybe in light of going home for Christmas, and this season tends to be kind of a bit of a shift in mentality for most people as we get into the spring and move that way. There's the beginning of, man, residency is, we're over the hump, if you will, and kind of on the downhill side, and spring's coming, and one day this is going to be over, and you all cry, and then what? So this is just a good reminder. 16, 1 through 3. Somebody read that.
The humans belong to plans of the heart, but from the Lord comes the proper answer of the tongue. All a person's ways seem pure to them, but motives are weighed by the Lord. Commit to the Lord whatever you do, and he will establish your plan.
All right. Derek, what version are you reading out of?
NIV.
NIV. You say the plan, the, to humans belong? The heart. Read verse 1 again for me.
To humans belong the plans of the heart, but from the Lord comes the proper answer of the tongue.
All right. What's the idea here? This is talking about planning and taking care of the things maybe that God has inspired you to do versus kind of holding with an open hand, man, what God's going to do. And I think it's a good reminder for all of us. We all have dreams. We all have aspirations. We all have things in life that we desire to do. And it's great to be able to put those out there. One of the most difficult assignments I ever did, I think I shared this with you guys, was in a program similar to this that Shay and I and Brad all went through. And we had to do a life map. And literally it was in, what are you going to do in a year? What are you going to do in 5 years, in 10 years, 25 years? And you had to map the whole thing out. And it was like, man, I'm 23 years old, 22 years old. I don't have a clue. Like, it was the most painfully difficult process I've ever been through. Yeah, Jane.
Are you anywhere where you thought you would be?
In some areas, yes. I'm married and have kids. Aside from that, no. Not even in the least bit. But here's the reality of it. God tends to move vehicles that are moving, right? God doesn't move parked cars, if you will, right? So what I found in my life was, man, Lord, what do you want me to do? You know, I'll stick my finger in the wind and put up my sail, and pretty sure I know some of the things about your will for me to live with you and to walk with you. And man, if that's a preacher or a garbage man or a teacher or a flot or whatever, like that will is pretty wide. But I think I want to head in this direction. So I started college. I was pre-med and came to the Lord and realized, man, this is not what I want to do. I do not want to spend the rest of my life studying microbiology and drinking 8 cups of coffee at IHOP all night trying to study and pass tests. Like, this is not for me. I thought it was. It was a life goal of mine for probably 2 or 3 years at that point, and said, nope. What do you want me to do, Lord? So I started walking with him and looked around and like, man, I enjoy life groups. I enjoy ministry. Like, maybe, God, you want me to step into the ministry. So I just kind of began walking down that road, and doors open. And lo and behold, got a job at a church that we were working at and doing college ministry, and out of that, went to seminary, got a job at a seminary that I really enjoyed in Dallas, Watermark, that I've told you guys a little bit about. That door closed. I'm like, all right, Lord, what do you want me to do next? Got another job at a church in Sherman, Texas, this little podunk town north of where I grew up. All right, Lord, that was a miserable failure, partly because of my immaturity and partly because the relationship with the senior pastor and I, we were just oil and water, and we're good friends today and just didn't work out. So, Lord, what do you want me to do? And God opened the door to come to the well. So I come to the well in 2004. It was a third staff in 2004. You can believe that. We've got 60 some odd now, right? So came here, was working, and man, loved what I was doing, loved my job, loved teaching residency. There were parts of my job that I was like, Man, I'll plan another small group retreat and another life group gathering, but honestly, man, this is not what I'm passionate about. And God stuck me in a season where I was frustrated and didn't know what I wanted to do. Parts of my job I love, parts of my job I was like, man, please, Lord, let somebody else do that. But I didn't know what I wanted to do, and all of a sudden, God dropped off the front of my lap out of nowhere. And here I am 6-7 years later doing that. And man, based on what God's done in my past, will I be doing this when I'm 70? Probably not. So I don't know. But you know, that's his business. I'm going to continue to walk with him and do what I know. Point being is I said, Lord, what do you want me to do? And I made plans and said, God, this is what I feel like my gifts and my passions and my talents are. I'm going to prayerfully move in that direction. And God, at any point, if you want to steer me, if you want to close the door, if you want to, what, that's your business. I'm going to be faithful and try to do the things that I know to do. But the process to work through that was actually extremely helpful for me. And I did it maritally, I did it with my family in terms of what I wanted in those areas. I did it professionally, I did it spiritually. Like, what are my goals in these areas? What do I want to be about? So writing them down and putting flesh on them was difficult. And then setting like, okay, if I want to have this degree at some point in my life, I'm actually going to have to start on that at some point, right? I'm going to have to do these things. If I want to have this vocation, it's going to require this job and this internship, then man, I need to back that up and say, well, how long is that going to take? Man, if I want to run a marathon, then at probably some point I need to get out of bed and run a half mile, right? And then work up to the things that matter, okay? But the idea is, man, God honors that. He loves to see our plans as long as we hold them with an open hand, right? So the thing that you don't want to do is to be sitting in the middle of the sea with your sail down and just wandering aimlessly and just listening to the voices around you, not having an idea of where you want to go, right? So push forward, open doors, see what God's going to do. And if he directs you in certain areas, then respond to that. But don't lean on a shovel and pray for a hole. You know, work and dig and do the things that you need to do with the skills that God's given you and see where that leads. And is that going to look a lot different in 2025 than it does in 2016? Absolutely. And that's a good thing. Okay, so embrace that, know that, that's part of how God works, and if he laid it all out before us, then we wouldn't trust him, we wouldn't need faith, we wouldn't need any of those things, but the process is great, okay, so lean into that, but make sure you're prayerfully planning and considering and thinking about life, the gifts that God's given you, what fires you up, what you get out of bed for, and do that, and if God changes directions on you, then man, embrace that, okay, but don't be a man or a woman tossed by the waves of the sea without an anchor, without some sense of direction in your life, okay? Cool? So, especially kind of the second semester as residency begins to come to a close, you know, obviously previewing that for you, that begins to come on the horizon for a lot of people. What's next? Where am I going, right? How do I stay faithful in the now and yet think through what's God doing in new seasons of my life, okay? And a lot of you guys are in that decision. You're in kind of that, you're shifting in between third and fourth gear right now, and you're in that place of like, Lord, I'm not sure what's next. That's okay too, okay? But just continue to work that process. I stayed in that season of fog for a good long while, years, if you will, in my life. Still heading forward, but yet not knowing when the fog was going to clear and what God had for me. And he opened it up when he was ready to open it up in his good timing. So, okay? So, consider that. Good? All right. We finished Leviticus yesterday. You guys are going to give me a Leviticus chart. I know you're excited. Okay, so here's what I want. I want you to chart the book of Leviticus. Okay, like you charted the book of Acts or are charting the book of Acts. Yeah. You get to do another one. Thanks, Mike. Did you and Shay talk about this before you assigned these? Yes, we actually did. So Shay's walking you guys through how to chart. Okay, you've seen a couple of mine. What I want you to be able to do is handle the book of Leviticus like a basketball. I want you to be able to palm it. And if you were sitting across the table from someone and had the ability in 30 seconds to walk them through Leviticus, I want your chart to be able to do that. Here's the theme of Leviticus. Here are the major breakdowns of the book. Oh, we have 3 minutes together? Okay. Let me talk to you more about the offerings. This is the offerings that are mentioned. And this is kind of the, you know, 8 through 10, what's happening in this period, right? And then this is 11 through 15. Okay. I'm giving you the breakdown of the book, by the way. You guys already know all this stuff, right? This is nothing new, okay? And then if you had the detail to continue to dig and you had an hour to spend with someone and say, man, before I teach you Leviticus, let me walk you through the whole book. Let me walk you through what it is and where it's going and the purposes and some of the details and that sort of thing, okay? So on one page, I want you guys to be able to palm the book of Leviticus and be able to walk from a 30,000-foot view of the book down to maybe some details that you see that are super important, verses that stand out amongst others, themes in the book that you're seeing, and that sort of thing. Okay? So, I'd encourage you at the beginning to not consult other sources, probably just like you did with Acts. Don't go Google Leviticus chart, you know. I know you can do that, and I trust that you won't. But start by forming an outline on your own. Okay, get it together. Then if you want to reference other sources and make sure that, you know, you called chapters 1 through 7 one thing, and you're like, oh gosh, but these really smart guys and gals called them something else, well, maybe that's good to consider. Okay, so if you said that they were about something else and they said their offerings, then you may want to consider that. Okay, but at the beginning, I'd encourage you guys to work through it on your own and get that template together. Okay, I don't care what it looks like. It needs to be effective for you. It needs to be professional, okay? So don't hand it to me on a pulled out piece of scrap paper from a notebook that's been penciled in that you did in the parking lot at 5:50, okay, before you came in. I don't want to see that. This is a tool for you guys. So it's not for me. This is for you. And this will help you as you, if you can believe this, teach Leviticus in the future, right? That one day when God says, Kyle, I really need you to teach Leviticus today. And you go, I got it. What do you want? Come on. Right? So how about... So we're on break. If we looked at the first week we're back, the December 9th, that would be, January, hello. We're off the week of the, The 6th would be three Fridays from now. That gives you 3.5 weeks to work on it. Is that fair over break?
Yes.
Is that enough time? Yes. Jane says no, okay. Convince me, Jane. What do you need more than that? If I gave you more than that, would it actually help, or is it just going to further delay the process?
You can give us 2 months.
I could. Only one person brought me candy today, though, so. Bribes. They're bribes. They're all bribes. What do you got, Teasy? What do you guys need? Do you need more? One more week? Okay, so we gave you through the 13th. Okay, they are due January 13th. That is Friday, okay, 6 a.m. when you walk in, okay? Friday the 13th.
I'm going to be talking to him by tomorrow, honestly.
Dude, if you got those kind of skills, awesome, okay? Pull an all-nighter, go for it. Friday the 13th, okay, that's when they're due. January, Friday the 13th. Cool? All right? If you want to email them to me digitally, great. I would encourage you guys in a digital age to do your charts digitally. They will help because then when you change them and decide that you want to tweak them or whatever, then you can. Okay? Cool. You're welcome. So, January 13th. Good?
Yes.
All right. So, Numbers. This book is, there's no words in it. I don't know if you knew that. It's all numbers. It's really strange. All numbers. Let me pray for us and then we'll dive back in. God, thanks for another week to study your word as we continue to journey through the Old Testament and watch your people and you lead them and govern them as we see kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly, especially today, Father, with your people. Continue to show us, God, their errors, their successes, the way they walked with you and the way they didn't. Teach us what it is to walk in obedience, to be sons and daughters of the King, and for you to be our good shepherd, Father, would you help us to embrace all that we learn and see today. In Christ's name, amen. All right, now, Book of Numbers. Okay, I will give you a breakdown of this. Okay, major theme of the Book of Numbers is chastening. Okay, this is a book where God is basically putting the old generation, the generation that we've been dealing with, he's putting all of their hands on the proverbial chalkboard, and he's taking out his paddle. And he said, hey, we need to work some stuff out of you that maybe isn't so good. I'm going to chasten you. I'm going to lead you through difficulty. This is kind of Israel's discipleship lesson. That's what the ultimate breakdown of the book is going to be about, of God kind of working the things out of them that they need to get worked out, primarily Egypt. He's trying to work Egypt out of the people. So chastening, discipline, okay, one of those themes would be good, okay? Very simple breakdown of the book, okay? Three major sections, 1 through 10, 11 through 25, and then 26 through 30, 36. Those are the three major sections of Numbers. 1 through 10 is all about preparation, okay? We're going to spend 10 chapters getting the people ready to move, okay? When we leave camp, here's how you're going to do it. Here's how you're going to pack up shop. Here's what order you're going to leave in, okay? 1 through 10, all about preparation, okay? Preparation to move. 11 through 25 then is going to be dealing with the old generation. Okay, I say old, they're current to us, but they are the generation that's not going to go into the promised land. Okay, they are the generation that's going to continue to rebel, continue to push on Moses, continue to push on God, and God's ultimately going to say, I'm done, you're hard-heartedness, your lack of faith, your disobedience, you are all going to die in the wilderness, every one of you, 20 and up. Males and females, both. If you're 20 years old or older, that whole generation ultimately does not go into the wilderness, except for two dudes, okay? And we'll get to them in the text. So the old generation is going to die in the wilderness, okay? Then at 26 through 36 is all about, if that was the old generation, what do you think 26 through 36 about? The new generation, okay? Now, we've got to repeat the laws that we've already given in Exodus and Leviticus to the new generation. We've got to prep them to go. We're going to have a whole other book called the Second Law, Deuteronomy, Duat Nomos, Second Giving of the Law, so that the new generation and the people that were under 20 and that were in a baby Bjorn leaving Exodus could go, oh, this applies to me too. Yeah, I was sucking my thumb. I had no idea what you guys were talking about. They're going to have to embrace the law and go from there, okay? 1 through 10 preparation, 11 through 25, old generation, 26 through 36, the new generation, okay, with the big theme of God chastening his people. And we're going to see how he creatively works the Egypt out of the Israelites as they journey through the book of Numbers, okay? So, chapter 1 of Numbers, we find ourselves, again, still sitting at the base of Mount Sinai, okay? Took us 3 months after the Exodus, in Exodus chapter 12, to leave Egypt. It took us 3 months to get to the foot of Mount Sinai. We've been sitting there for now 11 months, this entire time through the book of Leviticus, and up through chapter 10, verse 11, we're going to continue to sit there. Everything that you're going to see in the verses that follow up through chapter 10, verse 11, the people are still sitting at the foot, base of Mount Sinai, okay? So, chapter 1, here's what God says, okay? The Lord spoke to Moses 1:1 in the wilderness of Sinai at the tent of meeting on the first of the second month in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. And he says, take a census. I want you to count everybody, okay? And you're going to count them by the sons of Israel, verse 2, by their families, by their households, by the numbers of their names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old, verse 3 and up, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel. So you're going to count dudes only, 20 years of age and up, who's able to go out to war, okay? That is the requirement for the census. All of the rest of chapter 1 is the breakdown of every tribe of Israel and how many people, how many males above 20 are in each clan, each family, each tribe, if you will, okay? So the book of Numbers begins with literally numbering the people, hence when that's how we get our name, okay? Now, chapter 1, verse 45, 20 years age and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, verse 46, here's our total number, 603,550 males above 20 that are able to go fight, okay? So let's just assume we got a 50-50 population, okay, of males to females. That gives us 1.2 million plus adults over 20, okay? You add about that to under 20 kids and so on, we're probably looking at anywhere from 1.5 to 3 million people in the wilderness, okay? That is a grip, again, of individuals, okay? So Moses says, count them. I don't know how long this took. It could not have been a quick process, but that's the idea, okay? However, verse 47, look who doesn't get counted.
The ancestral tribe of the Levites, however, was not counted along with the others.
Okay, they don't specifically get counted, okay? The reason being is in verse 50, you shall appoint Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, over all its furnishings, over all its belongings. They shall carry the tabernacle, take care of it, and camp around it. Verse 53, the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel. So, obviously there were men in the tribe of Levi that were over 20. Why would they have not been counted? They don't go to war, okay? Why? What's their job? Yeah. Now, just in case we're wondering if these guys are, you know, white-collar, sissy-fied, you know, cream-on-their-hands type dudes, is that the case? Are they unable to go to war? Okay, we saw that in Genesis, right? We saw it in 34, unfortunately, when Levi and Simeon went to battle and took revenge on their sister Dinah for the rape that occurred to her. They go to war. We see it in Exodus when the people are in sin. Moses comes down the hill and says, what the heck is going on? And he draws a line in the sand. He said, anybody who's on my side, you come over here. And the people that stepped over the line that said, Moses, we're with you, were the Levites. And Moses says, you take a sword to the guys that are committing this gross sin and you deal with it. And they do. So these aren't guys that aren't willing to go to war. God says, I have a more important job. And we're going to need another dude, a grandson of Aaron named Phinehas, who is a Levite. He's one of the JV priests, and he is bad. And you're going to see, it's not because these guys are sissified or whatever. God says, man, look, war is going to be an important aspect of what we do when we go into the land. However, your job is more important, and we need you to make sure that there is no wrath on the congregation, that you are atoning for the sins of the people. So they don't get counted. So chapter 1, that's where we get our number, okay? Chapter 2 is all about who camps where. Okay, we covered this in some pictures. My Bible's got like a little infographic on it, but it's all about where each tribe camps, okay? And again, the purpose of all this is that God was specific. He wanted to know where every tribe would be, and every time they rolled into camp, you always had the same spot, like on a clock. If you were Ephraim, you always camp at 7 o'clock. That's where you camp, okay? So that was your side. So you look through the text, and you see verse 2, now on the east side of the camp was so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. Verse 10 on the south side, verse 18 on the west side. So it just, the whole chapter is rolling through how they camp. I mean, we got 34 verses of where to camp. Isn't it crazy to you? Like, some of the things that God is just, like, insanely detailed about, and then there's texts that you're like, could you just give me a little more on that, right? Like, that really would have helped. Do we really need these 10 verses on, if you sit here and you sit like that, Indian style, crisscross apples, right? Just give me, right? But God is detailed in these areas that are extremely meaningful to him. So there's order, and you can imagine when you're dealing with 3 million people, it can't just be a free-for-all, you know, just find some open space wherever, right? He has them parked in a certain area for a reason, okay? Chapter 3, then, is all about the Levites, okay, and their specific duties, all right? This is a cool chapter. Let's see. Chapter 3, verse 5, God speaks now to Moses and says, bring the tribe of Levi to me before them. He brings Aaron in verse 6. They're going to perform the duties of the tabernacle. And in verse 12, God changes his original plan. When God freed the people from Egypt, and he removed the curse from all the firstborns, and he spared all the firstborns in Israel. What did he say about every firstborn in the nation of Israel? They're mine. I am taking every firstborn for my purposes. God says, you know what? We're actually going to do this different. Look at chapter 3, verse 12.
Behold, I have taken the Levites from among the people of Israel, instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the people of Israel.
Okay. So God changes his plan a little bit. We see this again in like chapter 8. Instead of taking every firstborn, what is he doing instead? He's taking all the Levites. Okay, how many firstborns do we have in here? Raise your hand. Okay, all of you are in the priesthood. I don't care if you want to be an architect. I don't care if you want to be whatever. You are a priest. Okay, that's just your lot in life. That's what you're going to be because you're a firstborn. Okay, especially males. Okay, now, whether you like that or think that's great or not, that's your duty. Then God says, you know what? Instead of taking you, Mike, I'm going to take this entire tribe on your behalf. Okay? So how do you feel about the Levites if you maybe had other aspirations in life, if you wanted to do things other than being a priest or work in the tabernacle? Thank you. Okay? You kind of paid my price for me. So the idea is he wants the people to have a certain sense of reverence for what the tribe of Levi is going to do. They are set aside. They are going to be holy. They are going to be the ones that are going to minister in the tabernacle. And he wants the people to understand, listen, this was a transaction. So instead of taking you, I still fulfilled my obligation, but you need to hold in reverence the job of the Levites because that would have been you. Okay, not in a negative way, but in an understanding of, man, they switched places with you. And to be clear, their job's pretty cool. It's not like they've got a bummer of a job. It's actually pretty awesome, okay? So that's the theme of 3:12, and we're going to see that repeated a couple times, okay? 3:17, there are three families within the tribe of Levi that get really cool jobs, okay? 3:17, these are the sons of Levi, okay? His literally his three sons, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Okay, and each one of these guys has a job in the carrying out of the duties of the tabernacle. Okay, look at this. Verse 25 describes the duties of the sons of Gershon, the Gershonites. Okay, read that.
Now the duties of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involved the tabernacle and the tent, its covering, and the screen for the doorway of the tent of meeting, and the hangings of the court, and the screen of the doorway of the court, which is around the tabernacle and the altar, and its cords, according to the service concerning them.
All right, so when God blows the trumpet, and or the cloud moves, or the fire by night, and they set out to leave camp, they've got to pack everything up, right? So the first thing to get packed is the tabernacle, okay? And we're going to see there's some things that happened previous to this. But the Gershonites, their job was to do what? What pieces of the tabernacle specifically were they responsible for? Yeah, it's like, it's basically the tent portion, okay? They were the guys who were actually picking up the Coleman tent, right? The tent structure itself. Not the poles, not the support systems, not anything in the tabernacle, but their job was to take the actual tent, fold it, move it, okay? Only the Gershonites got to do that, okay? If you're from Merari or if you're from Kohath, that wasn't your job. Only the Gershonites, okay? Verse 27 begins to get into the Kohathites, okay? The sons of Kohath, Kohathites, and what they did. Verse 30, the Kohathite family. Verse 31, here are their duties. Read that.
Now the duties involved the ark, the table, the lampstand, the altars, and the utensils of the sanctuary which they were to minister.
Okay, where did they get to move? All the fun stuff, right? Honestly, they're the only people that get to touch the ark. And they actually don't get to touch it. But they move the lampstand, the altar, all the implements of worship within the tabernacle. They move, okay? And literally, they would take a pole, and they would slide it through the rings of the ark. Aaron and his sons had already gone in and covered every piece of there. We see that in the book of Numbers with like a blanket so they can't see it. And they would slide those poles through. They would put the poles on their shoulder, and they would never actually touch the ark itself. They would just move it on their shoulders, okay? Just like kind of that scene in Indiana Jones. You guys have all seen that, yes? Okay, good. Just make sure you're all saved. That would be concerning. Man, got nervous. So that's the idea. You haven't seen it? Well, I'd get that done. If rapture occurs, then, you know.
It's like watching Star Wars.
That's most. You know what? There's a lot of people I make mad, but Tiana ain't one of them. And I would repent of your sin right now. So that's the idea, okay? So Merari, Kohath.
I would never touch that.
Was the guy who died as a result of touching it when the ox stumbled and whatever, was he a Kohathite?
No. No, we'll get there. Okay, 2 Samuel 7, a guy named Uzzah. There's a story of a guy later on during David's day that touches the ark, and we'll get to his story. Okay. That is chapter 3, verse 31, are the Kohathites. Okay, so chapter 3 is all about these guys. Okay, and then the sons of Merari, the Merarites, I don't know what you call them. They got a cool name, though. Sounds like Ferrari, but, you know. Verse 36, these guys are the, Brad would call them the hairy back knuckle draggers, I think, would be the proper term. 36, this is what they did.
Now the appointed duties of the sons of Ferrari involved the frames of the tabernacle, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, all its equipment, and the service concerning them.
All right, so these guys are literally getting the structure themselves. They're hucking the 2x4s over their shoulder, all the actual structure of the tabernacle itself. That's what they moved, okay? And you're going to see God graciously gives them provisions to do that. So it's kind of cool how he does it. We'll see that here in a couple more verses, okay? But that is the job of the sub-families of Levi, the three sons of Levi, Merari, Kohath, and Gershon, okay? And Ferrari. I almost said Ferrari twice. Alex has got me all messed up, okay? But that's the idea, okay? Repeated in verse 45, you see that idea? Take the Levites instead of all the firstborn, instead of the cattle, the Levites, all the Levites shall be mine, I am the Lord. Now, we get some numbers here and how many there are. We've got to make sure there's equal. Like, I would have taken X amount of firstborns from all 11 tribes to 12 tribes, but now from Levi, I'm taking every firstborn. Do those numbers work out? God gets into that. We won't get into that. But it basically, there's a few, too few Levites to take a one-for-one from every firstborn in the other tribes, and God kind of works out those details, okay? So, that's chapter 3. Who gets to touch what, okay? Chapter 4. This is kind of cool. God says now to Moses, take a census in verse 2 of the descendants of Kohath, of their families, so the sons of Levi. And this kind of applies to all the priests. And watch this, okay? Verse 3. Troy, read that.
No go.
Someone 4:3.
So all the men from 30 to 50 years of age who come to serve in the work at the tent of meeting.
Okay. He gives some age boundaries, okay, of when you can come work in the tent of meeting. What are they? 30 to 50. So if you're 22 and you're a Levite, do you get to serve in the tabernacle?
No.
No. Okay. If you're 59 and, right, do you get to serve?
No.
No. Okay, turn real quick to chapter 8, verse, left column, right hand side, 25. This applies, verse 24. This is what applies to the Levites. From 25 years old and upward, they shall enter to perform the service of the work of the tent of meeting. But at age 50, they shall retire from service, the work and not work anymore. Verse 26, they may, however, the old dudes, assist their brothers in the tent of meeting to keep an obligation, but they themselves shall do no work. Okay? Why did God do this? What is this about?
So pastors can retire at this age.
I think you're actually onto something, Aaron. Seriously. He's calling up the younger generation, okay, to say, hey, listen, you're going to have an on-ramp, okay? And old guys, you don't get to sit in the pulpit until you die with no succession plan. You need to be developing young men to come up after you. Okay?
Is that why he says that the older guys are there with them?
Correct.
So they're really kind of just watching over their shoulders, saying, don't do that, do that.
Correct. What do you think happens? So the first text in chapter 3, we saw 30 to 50. But in chapter 8, what does it say?
25.
25 to 30, right? You get a difference. What do you think happened for those 5 years?
Training.
An apprenticeship. Who do you think apprenticed them? 51-year-old priest. Hey, look, I've been doing this for 20 years. Let me give you some insight into what your job looks like. Let me tell you what you're going to be doing. Isn't that a brilliant program? Mm-hmm. Right? Part of their job was, man, look, yeah, you got to huck heavy stuff. So we don't need an 82-year-old guy with a bad back lifting up the ark, right? We need young men, okay, that are in their prime. So let's implement that. But I think the idea is God builds in a system where, look, you get 20 years to work at the Lord's work in the tabernacle. You get a 5-year apprenticeship before that, and then when you retire, do we just kick you out the pasture and say, see ya? No. See, man, you are the gray-haired, the aged, the men with wisdom. Teach the younger men what they need to know, but let them on, right? I heard a pastor in town years ago who said, my succession plan is when I die teaching in the pulpit. You can put me in a box and figure it out then. That was basically his succession plan. So how do you think every young, up-and-coming young man that had desires to be in the ministry felt in that church? It's horrible. Like, man, yeah, I either need to kill you or, and that's probably not going to help me out, right? But there's clearly a ceiling here. I can only do so much. I've got to go somewhere else that values youth in order to do anything revolving around ministry. And literally, this guy, man, if you work for his church, you did not order pens without asking him if it was okay to order pens. Like, he made every decision in the church. Every. It's bad, right? Pastors can be that way, a bit control freakish. Now, at the well, when we started 13, 14 years ago, we were all a bunch of 20-somethings, this verse looked great. Yeah, old farts, get out of the way, okay? Here we come. Now that I'm 41, Brad's 43, it's like, you know what, maybe not so much. So I don't know that these are hard boundaries today, but the idea is great. Listen, we've got to be about investing in the next generation, okay? They say if you're a gifted communicator, you can reach people 5 to 10 years older than you and 5 to 10 years older and 5 to 10 years younger than you, okay? But if someone wants to speak into a 5-16-year's life, you know who does it better than me? Hannah does it better than me. Because she's younger than me. So she's discipling my kid, right? Julian, the same. Alex, the same, because he's younger. He's more in touch with what's going on their world. So I need younger men and women that are pouring into my kids because there's that age deal. When my daughter is talking about dating as a 15-year-old, like I give her advice, our parents give them advice. However, she's got a gal in her life that's one of her leaders in the WSM ministry that is a 20-something that knows what dating is, that wasn't like two decades ago the last time they did it. And she's speaking wisdom into my daughter's life. And we're very concerned about what type of wisdom are you saying, what do you are, you know. So we're listening to her advice to say, do you listen to that or not? But it's healthy for my daughter to hear from a younger voice, okay? So think about that. A lot of you guys in a church are on the front side of that. Man, you are the people that are being developed and poured into, okay? Keep that standard about you as you get older and know that there are other people that are going to come up through the ranks that are gifted and talented men and women that need to be in some type of development program, and then they need to be set free to fly without ceilings, okay? It's much easier said than done when you're in the older generation, okay? Now, there are pastors that I know, men that are in their 70s, upper 70s, that are still bringing it. I mean, are amazing. So it's not to say that you can't still have an amazing ministry, but you've got to realize the maybe where you fit and where you don't and the extent of what you can do. Okay? So
with this, it was at 25, they start an apprenticeship with somebody who's 50, or that 45-year-old, before he leaves the tent,
I think it's the plus 50s. And again, this isn't explicitly said in the text. I'm inferring a little bit. Okay, so I think it's the plus 50 guys that it says you can still assist. You can still be around. We're not kicking you out. But you're not going to do the work. Those guys are going to do the work. So I think it's the 50 plus that are discipling the 25 to 30 and also helping, you know, the wet behind the ear 30-year-olds that are brand new to the same. Man, what do I do again? And where's the oil for the anointing? And how do I not do this fire wrong? Because I heard that went really bad one time, right?
I heard Shane Rick Taylor talking about these as they're approaching. And I'd imagine you and Brad kind of saying, oh, just thinking ahead. I'm just saying like 10 years from now. But they were saying that culturally, if you try to get hired on a pastor or in other areas of ministry, you're almost like cast aside because of your age.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, but it looks like that's what... That's what's happening here, though, in a sense.
Yeah. I think there's a certain age of maturity that needs to be in there, and it's not that a 22-year-old can't and that a 32-year-old can. I met a lot of 32-year-old 8-year-olds and a lot of 22-year-old 50-year-olds, you know what I mean, with maturity and a walk. I think God's mandating to say, listen, you don't get to hog the pulpit, so to say, so to speak, and you've got some maturing to do before you get to a certain place. So I think it's a both and. But yeah, I think that's the heart behind it. And to that point, yeah, I mean, you guys remember Jared Rumley? He took a church over in Sewanee, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, buckle of the Bible Belt type place, old school Baptist church. And man, there are people in there that are 80 that are looking at this 38, 39-year-old kid going, like, what do you got to tell me? Man, Jared is a mature, godly, seasoned ministry veteran. And there are old guys in that congregation that won't listen to a word he has to say. To their shame and to their folly, right? It's a shame, but that does occur, okay? The reason, by the way, that guys like that get heard is because there's a 60 or 70-year-old guy that says, that guy, you need to listen to him, okay? When Moses gets put on the bench and God says, you don't get to go to the promised land, he takes Joshua, raises up before all the people and says, this is your guy. I believe in him. You better believe in him. God believes in him. Listen to his voice. And in front of all the people, commissions this guy and says, this is the guy you're going to follow. And then Moses gets the heck out of the way. He actually dies, but, you know. So that's that. He really, yeah. So he's gone. Can you help me here, Moses? Nope, I'm gone. So, okay, so just keep that in the back of your minds for those of you guys that are doing that. Works in ministry. That works in other places. Find older men and women that can teach you your ways if you're younger. And as you guys get older and have wisdom and experience in certain areas of life, be it in the ministry or outside of it, man, pass those on to other people. Disciple other folks, okay?
You see in the same structure as well, like the body of the church.
Yeah. Hey, older men, you know, disciple younger men. Titus 2, older women, pour into younger women. Like, hello, that's a great concept. Get her.
How well do you think the well is doing in this regard?
I think we're doing okay. I think we could do better. I think the older our kind of core, the church just kind of, right as you move from a 24-year-old average age, every year that gets older, so we have a harder time reaching that younger generation, but I think we're making good strides to do that. It's a moving target, and we don't certainly have the answers. I think the heart is there. There's no desire, I think, in the senior leadership to say, you know, you can kick me out when I'm good and dead. So I think the heart of discipleship in doing that is there. Are there other places in town and other churches that are super effective at that and doing a great job? Absolutely. So we're not the only game in town, but, you know, I think we're always trying to figure out how to do that the correct way. So, okay.
It's true for me. I don't know about anybody else, but why do you think it is that somebody like me, I guess, will be quicker to listen to somebody who's not my parents? That's older than me,
mm-hmm.
than rather my parents who, like, know me and have been there since I was born.
Yeah, that's a good question. You have thought, Alex?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think just what we've, like, talked about in WSM is that the younger generation just follows what the culture does. And so Homer Simpson looks like an idiot. Peter Griffin looks like an idiot. And Marge Simpson is, like, in a whole other planet. And so what the media kind of portrays parents as are just like, they don't know what they're talking about.
Hmm.
And so I think that plays a huge part. It's definitely not all of it.
Yeah.
I think some of it's just intrinsic. Like, you just want to go to someone else and hear their opinion. But I think a huge part of it is the media.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I heard a note on that a while back of just how the media portrayed specifically fathers. Mm-hmm. And it's like, they're a bunch of idiots, right? They sit around, get waited upon, dumb. The Homer Simpsons of the world, right? And he's probably the quintessential example. I don't know if this happened to you guys. I remember being in college, late high school, and thinking, my parents are idiots, probably from about 14 to 20. And then all of a sudden, one day in college, I realized, you know what, my parents are actually pretty smart. They've navigated life and have done a lot and have been financially responsible and have jobs. And, like, maybe I should ask them. But there was, like, one of these overnight, like, huh. So I don't know what that was from or what it is, but there was a season where all of a sudden, like, ladies, when you have kids and all of a sudden you got a newborn at home, you know who you're going to call? Your mother. No matter how dumb you thought she was in a season of your life, you're looking for advice and wisdom and counsel because she's been there and done that, right? Same thing with me as a dad. I remember leaning back onto my dad and started hanging out with him and asking him questions, and all of a sudden he was smart again. Like, Dad, I don't know what happened to you for those 8 years, but boy, you were dumb.
It's interesting to see that, like, parents who have actually been mature in the faith are able to not only like Christ-centric and walking that out in their own home, not just appear to be on Sunday, that their kids tend to be more grateful for them, for their parents, and more honoring of them, especially when there's not a disconnect between church and culture, like mm-hmm. parents that know how to engage their mm-hmm. kids from a generational mm-hmm. cultural standpoint.
Yeah.
And so anyway, it's been kind of hooking to some of those dynamics as well.
It's good. Yeah, and your kids are going to see that, you know, you living out your faith and all of us, right? So that's hard. It's a challenge. So anyway, yep.
I wanted to say, too, I checked back in case you wanted to call.
Okay, you're back. Cool. Check back in. Love it. All right, so chapter 4, okay? So that's kind of the idea there. The big overarching theme is, man, God has given even subfamilies within Levi certain responsibilities. So if you didn't like your job as a Merarite or whatever, you didn't want to work at a certain age or did, I mean, these are the boundaries in your responsibilities that are on you. And if you drop the ball gets dropped, okay? All throughout the rest of chapter 4, we're numbering the Levites, so on and so forth, and going from there, okay? So that's chapter 4, numbering the Levites, giving them their jobs, telling them when they have an on-ramp and an off-ramp to do the work of the ministry, okay? We see later in the text that God basically says, I have given Aaron and his sons the tribe of Levi. Like, they are almost tied to them to do the work of the service of the tabernacle and all the duties that would have been involved therein, okay? Chapter 5 is a bizarre chapter, okay? It feels out of place in a way, but we'll read it. It's an odd deal, okay? Chapter 5, verse 1, command the sons of Israel that if they send away from every camp the leper, everyone who is discharged, everyone who is an unclean because of a dead person, you shall send them away, both male and female. Talking about leprosy here, how they get back into the camp. Verse 6, speak to the sons of Israel, when a man or a woman commits any of the sins of mankind, acting unfaithfully, he shall then confess his sin in verse 7, commanding, which he's committed, and make full restitution in verse 7, is wrong, and add to it. So some of these laws that we've seen before that are mentioned. And then in verse 12, we get this odd kind of like note from God. Okay, read that.
Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, so that another man has sexual relations with her, and this is hidden from her husband, and her impurity is undetected, since there is no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act.
Okay, here's the deal. You got a man and a woman that are living together, okay, married couple, and the man suspects that his wife has had an affair with another man. There's no evidence, per se. No one's caught her. God gives a process that they could go through to determine whether or not this woman had or had not done this. Okay? I don't know. Verse 14, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, so he is jealous of his wife when she has defiled herself, or a spirit of jealousy comes over him so that he is jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself, there's this process. Okay? Here's how it works. So I won't use myself as an example. A man thinks that his wife has had an affair. He would come to the priest in verse 5, bring his wife before the priest. They shall bring an offering of 1/10 of an ephah of barley meal. He shall pour oil upon it, frankincense on it. They're going to make this grain offering in verse 15. Verse 16, he shall bring her near and have her stand before the Lord, meaning in the tabernacle with the priest. Okay, the priest shall take, verse 17, holy water in a vessel. They're going to take this concoction that they made in verse 15, add holy water to it, make it a concoction, more or less. Verse 18, the priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the woman's hair of her head go loose, let her hair down in the place of the meal offering of the memorial of her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy in verse 18. And then in her hands, end of verse 18, will be the water of bitterness that's going to bring a curse. Okay, so this concoction that they made is going to be used basically to determine the truthfulness of this woman. Okay, verse 19, the priest shall have her take an oath and said, if no man has lain with you, in verse 19, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanliness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to the water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray, verse 20, being under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, verse 21, the priest will have the woman swear but the oath, and she's going to drink the water. Verse 21, this is the curse. Look at the end of verse 21. The Lord will make a curse and an oath among the people by the Lord, saying, your thigh will waste away and your abdomen swell. What does that mean? Okay. This water, verse 22, shall bring a curse. It goes into your stomach, make your abdomen swell, and your thigh waste away. Okay? Anybody got a note on what that is?
Your womb.
Your womb. It's exactly what it is. It's a miscarriage. God is saying, I will give basically a divine miscarriage if you have gone out as a woman from underneath the authority of your husband in the family structure and slept with another man who's not your husband, had intercourse and conceived. I will have you have a miscarriage. And not just that, God says, I will make you from here moving forward sterile. You will not be able to conceive children from this point forward. Okay. If everything's fine and the husband's brought about a false accusation, she's fine. They're going to have a pretty gank marriage. But that's the idea. Okay. So I know some of you are just dying to ask a question, but let's finish this here. Why is this here? Why would God, in the midst of this journey and getting ready to leave camp at Sinai, suddenly in chapter 5 go, okay, we need to deal with this? Probably because it was happening. Okay? Yeah, Jimmy?
Was there a lot of people that were doing other things than this? They were. Is this basically giving them a way to show that instead of them doing their own thing, do it through his way?
I mean, it's obviously bringing about the ideal of marriage. We don't see this ever done, by the way, in the text. There's never a story recorded of this happening. But you got 3 million people living together in the wilderness in tents. I think that's kind of the idea, and you're going to see the people that they run into. Okay, yeah.
I think that God. Well, I know that God takes adultery seriously because, like, cheating on your spouse is symbolic of like cheating on God. And then I think the reason why he probably does the miscarriage is to symbolize that, like, when a woman goes out and sleeps with another man, like, it's symbolic of her, of us leaving God and trying to find life in someone else.
Yep.
And so he stops life and says there's no life in
it. Yeah. I.e. the book of Hosea, right? It's all a picture of a prostitute that leaves the shelter of her husband, and God basically says, that's Israel. That's Israel who's left me, right? That's Gomer, right? Now, what bugs you about this, ladies?
Why are we assuming that women are the only ones doing this?
Right? I'm with you.
Because clearly women are more.
You want to throw that at him?
Yes,
what do you want to throw that at him? Yeah, I don't know. Okay, I do know. I don't know.
No, you do know or you don't know?
I don't. I do. I have a hypothesis, okay? Is that what God's saying? Troy obviously doesn't believe that, right? Or could guys be just as guilty? Absolutely. Yeah, I've seen your wife. Yes, you would. She is not playing around. I think the idea is we're reconfirming the family structure is the head of the household is the man. He's responsible to lead spiritually. If a man has an affair, what did we see as the consequences of that in the book of Leviticus? Something death. Like, if you had an affair, we didn't just kill the woman, we killed both of them. So there's not like a gradient of sin, if you will. But I think underneath the auspices of the family structure, God gives this ability to the male and not the female for whatever reason. So I'm with you. It's a bit odd.
Does this scripture, like, provide grounds for, like, there's many denominations I feel like that, like, will not consult on divorce or, like, talk through adultery and all that stuff. Is this why, like, do they still view it as, like, throughout the scripture, is it relieved of its weight? Or, like, are we supposed to still look at people like this? Like, sorry.
Ask your question concisely. What are you asking?
I'm trying to
work. Is this giving biblical grounds for male domination?
No. Yes, that's, like, part of it. But, like, modern day, how are we supposed to look at adultery? Because, you know, she's dead and crossed.
The first part of your question, absolutely not. No, we see God's system in place and a male's responsibility. The husband is to love his bride as Christ loved the church, right? Sacrificially and that sort of thing. So absolutely not. Is the weight of adultery today any different than the weight of adultery that it was back then? No. The same heart that grieved God here is how he responds to it today. Because marriage is a divine institution. We need to remember that. Like, God cares about this. So that's why we need to care about it as believers. These aren't just as hard as it is in our society today to say, listen, God created the male and female and to be one. Like, that was his plan for marriage. He values that institution greatly in the way that we honor it. So is this what's supposed to happen today if that happens? No. This was back then. But
does this tie in with that scripture that talks about, like, because isn't there a scripture that says, like, if you are in adultery, you're always one?
1 Corinthians 7 speaks to the idea of marriage and divorce and remarriage and some of those issues, so similar. But yes, if you're a believer, under the right circumstances, if you are married to a believer and you guys are fully committed walking with the Lord and you have a divorce for whatever reason, and there are reasons that God permits divorce, he says to those believers, you are not permitted to remarry because of the institution of the covenant of marriage. And there's other takes on that. There's good people that follow different degrees with that, but if you have a divorce, not the death of a spouse or something like that, but if Michelle and I today have a divorce and we are both committed followers of Christ, for whatever reason, she is unpermitted to remarry, as am I. That is my take on that. Okay, now if you're married to an unbelieving spouse and the spouse leaves, 1 Corinthians talks about that. I'm like, hey, if that spouse leaves and you've tried to reconcile, they're the unbeliever, they're the ones that left, there seems to be a window to say, yeah, then in that situation, the believing spouse could remarry, okay? But again, I think there's at times that we take this lightly, right? In Israel, if you committed adultery, you died. Man, if you work at IBM and you have an affair on your wife, ain't nobody care, right? Okay, bummer. You still got your job, you still got your life. Nothing happens. This is that odd thing about our society. In times where I go, you know what, we probably be good to remember this. God takes this seriously.
You're jacked up then, too. I mean, Jesus says in Matthew 19, they're asking, well, why did Moses permit this to get us to the divorce?
Yeah.
And Jesus says, because your heart's jacked. That's
yeah.
Why. And so, I mean, they were just as wretched as we are today in terms of wanting to divorce, yeah. Marry, divorce.
Yeah. Marry. Guys are looking for outs. Like, how can I release this woman? She burnt my French fries again, so I want out. God's like, yeah. No, no, but yes, because you're an idiot. So I have to do that. So
I also feel like in the culture that we're in right now, it's really easy to like how we always talk about like God is a God of grace, and that's true. But in that, we forget how much He hates sin. So like to me, this reminds me of when they were talking about strange fire. Like when you come at it like so flippantly, like there's consequences, and there's still consequences now. They just look different. So
yeah.
Like, I don't really see it as like. I don't see it as unfair. I see it as, like, God's holy, and, like, He takes it that seriously.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's like a warning.
In Malachi 3, God says, I hate divorce. Hate is a strong word, right? I think we need to remember that. And I think one of the greatest examples we can have as believers is how we handle our spouses, right? To honor them, to respect them, to love them. You know, joke around with you two carrying each other around this morning. That's great to see, right? That you guys love each other. Like, that's God-honoring and good. And the way that the outside world looks at our marriages, man, I get so tired of hanging out with unbelievers that are barking about their spouses. I'm like, man, come on. Up your game.
It's easy to be, like, irritated at it, but if you don't do anything wrong, nothing happens. So,
right. So, keep that in mind. God is serious about the institution of marriage, okay? We as believers need to care about this. It's God's institution. It's not the government's. God started this, and He cares about it because it's a picture of our relationship with Him. Again, pictures. So and that's why God cares. Okay. So that's chapter 5. I don't know why there's never a command for the woman to be able to do the same. It's not in the text. Okay. And there's never an instance where a guy takes his wife before the priest and does this. Okay. Because they probably all married to... You know, Troy's wife, and they said, oh, man, she'll put me in a headlock, and I'll be sleeping on the couch for a week. So.
She does all this.
Yeah. What's that?
What if she admits it before she does all this?
Then she would be killed along with the guy that slept with her.
Is there any instance of this?
She'll die?
Yeah. Along with the man that committed the sin, both of them. Yes.
So even if she admits, like, yeah, I'm at fault.
That's the punishment for adultery. Yep. Yep.
So,
so it's actually better to not admit it because you don't die, you just can't have children.
So.
Is that what, like...
Is that what we're to learn here? I don't think so. I'm pretty sure that's not the lesson.
I'm not saying that. That's what it's telling.
Mike, what I hear you saying is...
I'm saying it's almost like encouraging you to lie because it's... An easier punishment.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Great. So.
I think it's encouraging
that they go through this process.
If they go through this process and it turns out that she did commit adultery, would she still be put to death?
Yeah. It seems like it. Though this text says, without proof. And that's kind of what this process was for, to, and it doesn't speak of death in this chapter specifically, we see it in other places, but her thigh would waste away, so this doesn't speak to, and go kill the woman, and the dude, so, but we know that that's God's heart in other places.
I'm sorry, I'm just feeling convicted here, like, you guys, we have to look at this at the standpoint that he didn't just, like, accidentally slip and fall and, like, land on him, and then all of a sudden impregnate, like, or like there's a damaging issue within the marriage that has just happened last week. He's gonna be like, dude, I'm gonna cause a curse on you. Like, recognize that cheating starts with the flirt and with the hardening of our heart, as it talks about in, like, Troy in Matthew 19. Like, Jesus gave the law of Moses, or gave the law to Moses, because of the man's hardened heart. And if we don't recognize it, and this is coming from a guy who has gone through divorce, like, I have had a hardened heart, I did cheat on my wife, and recognizing that the steps didn't happen of me just showing up and be like, oh, you know, I'm going to cheat on my wife, and that's okay, and then she'll get over it. Like, this is a step process. It was years worth of turning away from God and years worth of recognizing that I am my own man, not God. And so these things are recognizing or that are influencing this people are to have us turn to God, not try to figure out a loophole of how this is going to punish or how this is going to not punish us by a certain way. This is turning towards God. And until we recognize that we turn towards God and that we honor the design of marriage and the intent of it, that we will always be short of the punishment that we have coming towards us if we try to find the loophole to it. So we should honor our wife, we should honor our husbands, we should honor the relationship that he has set up for us, because he understands the desires of our flesh, and he has allowed us to go into this covenant with this love covenant with another person, and it's his design. So if we try to do anything outside of that design, that's the problem. Good. Male or female.
It's good. So Joseph's a little bit passionate about marriage, if you can't tell. So as you should be. Okay, it's good. It's great. Okay. Well said. Singles, take this seriously, okay? Marry right. Don't screw this up, okay? That's a great reminder for all of you guys. When you're in this institution, God cares about it. Honor it, okay? So do it right, and do it right the first time. It makes life a lot easier with a lot less baggage and U-Hauls full of junk that you got to deal with, okay? We got enough of those in ourselves that I bring into my marriage, much less, you know, having to not walk with God in that season. So kudos to you for having a high value of marriage and a good marriage at that. All right, let's keep moving, okay? Odd text, I know it's weird, okay? Chapter 6, the Nazarite vow. Okay, we talked about a little bit of this yesterday, okay? Chapter 6, verse 1, God speaks to Moses and says, speak to the sons of Israel, verse 2, tell them when a man or a woman desires to take a special vow, the vow of the Nazarite, to dedicate themselves, they're going to do all these things. So I want you to think about the Nazarite like a monk, modern-day monk, okay? These are non-Levites, but these are people that are like, hey, look, I want to do something nuts. I want to do something crazy for a season of my life. I want to be set aside, and I want to commit my life to the Lord almost in a priest-like way, but I'm from Judah. Can I do that? God says, game on. Absolutely. Man or woman, here's what you do, okay? These are kind of the boundary markers if you're a Nazarite. Verse 3, you'll abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, which I don't imagine that would be difficult. If you've ever had vinegar, it's nasty. I don't know why people in Israel would be drinking that, but whatever. Whether he made from wine or strong drink, neither be he drink any grape juice or anything fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation, verse 4. He shall eat nothing that is produced from the grape skin. Verse 5, all the days of his vow, no razor shall pass over his head, so no haircut. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled, which the Lord has separated himself in verse 5, and he shall let the locks of his hair grow long. Verse 6, all the days of his separation, he shall not go near a dead person, anything dead. Verse 7, he shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother or his brother, meaning if they die, you don't touch them and you don't go to the funeral, like the high priest. You can't even attend their funeral because death is this really big deal. Okay, so here's in summary, in this culture where wine is at the table at basically every meal, no wine, no grapes, no dead people, nothing made from vinegar, no haircut, and no contact with the dead. Like, this is a pretty big commitment.
From a food standpoint, so if you're at the dinner table, you can't have wine, obviously.
Yep.
Can you eat like chicken or steak or something like that?
Yep. Okay. Yep. You can eat whatever everybody else eats, but how about it? Passover. 4 cups of wine. You're out. How about it? Shabbat on Friday evenings when you're celebrating the Sabbath. They drink wine. You don't. The idea is, man, this is a continual, often sacrifice to remind you that, man, you're denying yourself certain things to be set apart for a season, for whatever reason. We don't have the why behind this, by the way. We don't know why people take on the Nazarite vow. There's suggestions. We see that, obviously, Samson did it. Samuel does it, and his parents literally do it for him, as does Samson's. Set apart from the womb, a Nazarite from the womb. Those were the exceptions, by the way. Normally, it was a season for however long, but it had a start and it had a finish. Okay, and you finished it by cutting your hair and finishing your vow and then offering the sacrifices that we'll look at here in a second.
Now, this will be obviously... I don't want to overemphasize this, but it'll be obviously easy for us in our day and age. It's
not like we're cutting out turkey, chicken, you know, all the good stuff. It's just like wine not cutting your hair. I mean, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, does this, like, because this was obviously hard in their culture. Because, like you said, the Passover,
yes,
all these things would occur that,
yes,
was just like tempting and it's just like easy for them.
Yes.
Does, now, will this be looking different for our day and age? I mean, I know that Paul did it in the New Testament. And so if he did exactly these rules right here, but he was still in that culture,
yeah,
that day and age.
In Jewish culture, this would have been difficult. These would have been things that were common and around you all the time.
No,
every,
sure,
party, every wedding. Yeah. So it's the normal stuff of life, right? I don't struggle with not drinking vinegar, okay? Obviously, that's the basis of grapes and stuff like that, so with wine. So these are common things of their culture that would have been difficult and thought-provoking to have to avoid and abstain from.
So
parties, celebrations, weddings. Potentially, it would be similar to that in some regards, yeah.
Is there a way that we could do that now, scripturally, or is it just you would make your own, like a lot of people do with Lent?
Yeah. I think you got to be careful. Lent's one of those weird things. It's not... Yeah, as an example. So I hear you. I think the whole concept of denial and those sorts of things can be good. Lent deal aside, I think they can. Fasting, as Aaron brought up, is a great example of that. Like, you're denying yourself physical food to remind yourself, man doesn't live on bread and water alone, but everything that comes out of the mouth of the Lord. So maybe to deny myself certain things is going to help me tap into the spiritual realities of what's going on around me and to walk with God. So potentially, there's no magic in this. There's no whatever, and it almost seems that way at times. And different people have suggested why somebody would do this, but at the very least, it's a big commitment. It has to be honored. And if you make a commitment to do it for 6 years, and you touch a dead person in year five, you start over. You cut your hair and you start from day one, and you finish your commitment again. So it's not something that you just back out of because you decide you don't want to do it halfway through your commitment. So that's the idea. Now, look at 12 and following. Talks about the days of your separation, all that you're going to do. But when you're done, verse 13, this is the law of the Nazarite. When his days of the separation are fulfilled, he shall come to the doorway of the tent of meeting, go to the tabernacle. Verse 14, you're going to present your offering to the Lord, a male lamb, 1 year old without defect for a burnt offering, a ewe lamb, a year old without defect for a sin offering, a ram without defect for a peace offering. Okay, that's three highly valuable animals. Okay, a basket of unleavened cakes, fine flour mixed with oil. Verse 15, we talked about this the other day, but the idea is this is expensive. This isn't something you do on your own. This is communal, and you would have to get help from people around you to complete the vow. Okay, that's the picture. So the why is mysterious, but it certainly is a big commitment on the offerer's part that wants to live out a certain standard for a season of life. And God allows that outside of just the tribe of Levi to do that. Okay, so that is the Nazarite vow. Okay?
Did Samson actually choose this for himself? Because I got the impression it was chosen for him by his parents.
It was chosen for him, yeah.
So is there any reason why he wouldn't have been rebellious if it's not something he chose for himself, which is obviously like a pretty strict set of rules?
Because he just doesn't care.
It's because of his, I think it was because of when the angel came to him.
Yep.
The destiny was chosen for him.
Yeah. So it was bestowed upon him. Obviously, to his chagrin, he did not care for it and lived his life with that attitude of things of God are unimportant to me and I don't want to do that. So, and we'll see that throughout Samson's life. Samson's a buffoon. We paint him completely wrong, by the way, in Sunday school classes. He has some redeeming qualities, don't get me wrong. But for the most part, he's a selfish, self-centered buffoon. So just like me. So he's a good reminder to all of us of what we can be on a bad day. We'll get there in Judges, but he's a mess. Okay, 24. You guys have heard this before. This is the Aaronic blessing. Last part of chapter 6. The Lord bless you. The Lord keep you. Verse 25. The Lord make his face to shine on you and be gracious to you, to lift you up in his countenance upon you and give you peace. This is the prayer that God gave to Aaron at the conclusion of the ceremonies and stuff like that when they were in the tabernacle. You've said it probably 100 times. You've seen it on a card before at Hallmark, right? These are Numbers chapter 6, verse 24, the Aaronic blessing. This is where it comes from. It was given to Aaron to verse 27, so that they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I will bless them. So Aaron would bless you, the high priest, and the other Levites would bless the offers and so forth with that blessing. Okay, cool deal. Yeah, Jimmy. Nope, just, all right, shake it. Cool. All right, chapter 7, okay? I told you before that the sons of Merari, Kohath, and Gershon had certain duties. Verse 7, by the way, chapter 7, the leaders tithe to these families the goods that they would need to perform their duties. So, man, if you've got to carry a bunch of 2x4s around, God doesn't expect them to put them on their shoulders. He says, man, you're going to get carts, okay? Verse 3, the leaders of the congregation from all the tribes tied to them carts. So they gave them these things. 6 covered carts for 12 oxen, cart for every 2 of the leaders. All these things are provided for the sons of Gershon. Chapter 7, all of it is the lists of the tithes basically made to the sons of Levi by the leadership. Not the common people, the leaders, okay? The leaders went first, okay? The leaders gave to the building project. The leaders gave to the building of the tabernacle. The leaders gave to the Levites. They're not the exception. Just because you're on paid staff at a church doesn't mean that you don't tithe, right? That's the idea. The leaders were contributors and worshipers just like everybody else, okay? So that's all of chapter 7. Okay, you can read through all that they offered. There's 89 verses of what they gave. It's great. Moving on. Okay. Chapter 8, again, more kind of random laws, stuff about the lampstand, odd things about the priests. Look at chapter 8, verse 6. Somebody read that.
Take the Levites from among the sons of Israel and cleanse them. Thus you shall do to them for their cleansing. Sprinkle purifying water on them. Let them use a razor over their whole body and wash their clothes, and they will be clean.
So if you're a Levite, you shave your legs, shave your armpits, right? That's okay. I don't know. You guys figure it out. So one of those texts, I'm like, all right, you can ask God when you get there. But as a cyclist, I can appreciate that he shaves his legs. So not in the winter, though. So
Middle Eastern people, like, these aren't, like...
These are hairy dudes, right? Yeah, these are not, yeah... Middle Easterners tend to be a little bit more hairy, but that was part of the role of a priest, okay? They would shave their whole body as part of their, like, inaugural ceremony. They didn't trim their beards and such, so I think this was kind of like a one-time consecration thing. I don't know that they always did that, but again, it's mentioned here. It's just an odd verse, okay? The rest of chapter 8 is kind of God setting aside the Levitical tribe as helpers to Aaron. Verse 10, you see some of the imagery that we've seen before. Present the Levites before the Lord, the sons of Israel. They shall lay their hands on the Levites. They're going to commission them publicly. The Levites then are going to have a sin offering offered on their behalf. They're going to put their hands on the bull, right? The imageries that we've seen before so that they can minister. God reminds them in verse 16, these are the people that I'm taking instead of every firstborn. I've given, in verse 19, the Levites as a gift to Aaron and his sons, basically to serve in the priesthood. And then we kind of read the rest of that already, end of chapter 8, where God says 25 now to 50 are your boundary markers of when you can serve in that. Okay? So, that's 8.
Can you clarify to me why the Israelites were so important again?
Why the Levites or the Israelites?
Who was set aside?
The Levites.
Levites, yeah.
Yeah. So instead of every firstborn that God said, I'm going to take the firstborn of every tribe, instead of them, I'm going to take an entire tribe that's going to serve in your place. So the firstborns essentially got their life back. Kind of sounds like a deal, but or a bad deal, but it wasn't that way. But the Levites were basically a substitutionary atonement for all the firstborns from all the other tribes. So instead of them having to do it, now the Levites get to do it. So that was the view, that was the picture that you're supposed to see. Not atonement per se, but they served in your place. The idea is you're grateful, you appreciate them, the duties that they would have to be performing day and night. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, chapter 9, odd text. Guy comes to Moses and says, hey, we had Passover. There was a couple people that were unclean during Passover. They couldn't celebrate Passover. They touched a dead body. They had... an itchy, oozy scab. They couldn't celebrate Passover. They want to celebrate Passover. Can they do it? And God says, yeah, let's give them a redo. So if you were unclean for a certain reason, chapter 9 gives you like 1 month later an ability to now re-celebrate Passover. So kind of cool. So you actually see the heart of some of the people was like, hey, I got left out because I was unclean. I wasn't in sin, but but I was unclean and I couldn't celebrate with my people. Is there like a Passover take two? And God says, yeah, that actually makes sense. I like that. So he institutes chapter 9 and following the ability to basically redo Passover. Okay, so rest of chapter 9, we get some details on how they're going to be led in the wilderness. We've talked about this. Chapter 9, verse 16, so it was continually, the cloud would cover it by day, it being the Ark of the Testimony and the tabernacle, an appearance of fire by night. Okay, so you had a divine nightlight in your midst. That was the presence of God and a pillar of fire. And then during the day, it was a cloud. Okay, verse 18, at the command of the Lord, the sons of Israel would set out. At the command of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud settled over the tabernacle, the camp remained. Okay, and it literally says, verse 22, whether it was 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud lingered over the tabernacle, you had no idea. You don't know how long you're going to stay at this particular campground. It could be for a year. It could be overnight. And you just followed the cloud. That's what you did. Okay? So that was the picture. Okay? Now, chapter 10, we're getting ready to move. Okay? So we're going to see now the people of God for the first time move in the wilderness. Okay, I know you're so excited. You've been waiting for this for like 2 books now. I can't wait for them to move. But here they go. Okay? So chapter 10, the Lord spoke to Moses and says, you're going to make 2 trumpets of silver. When you see the cloud move, Moses, you're going to blow a trumpet, a shofar, a ram's horn, if you will, and we're going to, that's going to be the announcement to the people that God's on the move and you will be too. And just like you can imagine, all the people go through their job. So priesthood goes in first, Aaron and his boys cover all the implements of the tabernacle, then the Kohathites, the Merarites, the Ferrari guys, they all go in, take their portions, they pack up the tabernacle, they go, and then they are followed by each camp. Based on where they are camped around the tabernacle, each tribe then leaves in succession.
Now, it will take them a while to obviously pack all this stuff up. Mm-hmm. So the cloud will like wait for them.
I hope so. Slow down! Yeah. Yeah. That was the idea, okay? So chapter 10, verse 11, for the very first time, the cloud was lifted from the Ark of the Testimony. The sons of Israel, verse 12, set out. Verse 14, Judah goes first, then Issachar, and ad infinitum, okay? So they begin to move based on when God moves, okay? So we've read most of this and kind of get the idea. Verse 29, this is kind of cool. Somebody pick up there in chapter 10, verse 29 and read this. Moses' conversation with his brother-in-law.
Are the trumpets insignificant to similar trumpets being blown at Revelations, like it's time to move, time to go?
I'd probably more compare them to the shofar, like the Day of Atonement and the ram's horn that was blown. They would have been similar in style to that. It's the idea that it's an announcement to the people that something's happening. Okay. So, yeah, I wouldn't link that too much. Okay, 10:29.
Now Moses said to Hobab, son of Reuel.
That's a bad name, by the way, man. Hobab. Somebody name your kid Hobab. That would be awesome. I like Hobab.
Hobab Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law.
Jethro, okay, Reuel, same dude. So this is Moses' brother-in-law, Hobab, okay?
We are setting out for the place about which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will treat you well, for the Lord has promised good things to Israel. He answered, no, I will not go. I am going back to my own land and my own people. But Moses said, please do not leave us. You know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you can be our eyes.
This is interesting. So Moses says to this guy, his brother-in-law, hey, bro, you've been here with us at the base of Mount Sinai. We're leaving. This is your turf. You know where to go. Why don't you come with us? Be our guide. Be our Bear Grylls. You know where water is. You know where how to navigate this. Man, I need somebody like you. Hobab says, I'm going back to Midian, bro. I'm out. And he says, man, please don't. Like, you can be our eyes. You can take care of us. You get the impression, based on text that we see, that he relents and says, okay. So here you've got a non-Christian, Hobab, a Midianite. He may be a believer. We don't know. But Moses says, man, it would be good for me to bring a guy that knows the terrain, that knows the turf. Is that at times okay for a Christian to consult the advice of a non-Christian because they're an expert in an area? Yeah, so Moses is wise enough to say, yeah, like, dude, you know this area better than me. Come with us. Help me. Man, I shepherd sheep, but, dude, I am not. I can't read a compass, so help me, right? And Hobab is the guy that could do it, and he takes him with him. So Just a bit of a sermon within a sermon, but man, there are times as believers that, man, you want to know finances? You got a wicked good financial counselor that doesn't know the Lord? Okay, listen to him. You know, take what advice you can. If there are people that are really good at plumbing that don't know the Lord, great, they can fix toilets. That's fine. Listen to them, right? You don't have to have a Christian counsel for everything. So Moses realizes this is not his wheelhouse. It is Hobab's, so he brings him with him. So smart guy, even when you're the guy that God's going to lead you, he takes Hobab with him, okay? So chapter 10 is kind of them heading out of town for the very first time, okay? Now, chapter 11 starts kind of a different feel, okay? We've been prepping to move. Now for the first time, we're going to leave Mount Sinai. We're going to head now northeast out of the Sinai Peninsula, up towards the southern Negev of Israel. We're going to head kind of in that direction, but it gets ugly fast. Chapter 11, verse 1. Okay, and I want you guys to take note of this. This is a fascinating string of chapters that culminate in chapter 16. So 11 through 16 are all kind of telling, with a couple of parentheses in there, a very similar story. Okay, 11, 1.
Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord. And when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp.
Whoa, what just happened? Like in one verse, people are barking and God's throwing torches again. Like, holy cow. But you're getting the feel for, this is what these people do. They complain. They bark about everything, right? And here's what they're barking about. Keep reading.
When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord and the fire died down. So that place was called Taberah.
Yep.
Because fire from the Lord had burned among them.
Okay, now I want you to notice the people that are complaining. Where does it specifically say they are? On the outside of the camp. Okay, so you've got tabernacle here. You've got, you know, all the camps and where you would have everybody go. Do you guys remember when they left Egypt? It said there was a group of people that came with them. Yeah. Who was that? That were not Israelites.
The Midians?
The Egyptians. The Egyptians. They're called, in verse 4, the rabble. Okay? They didn't have a place to camp. Where do you think they camped? Yeah, okay. On the outskirts of the camp. So these are non-Jewish, non-Hebrew people that are camped on the outside. Why did they leave to go out of Egypt with the Israelites into the wilderness? In some sense, what did they just seen 10 times over? A really sweet magic show. Your God does really cool stuff, okay? He's a vending machine God, okay? He does all these miracles. He's a big deal. I'm going with you guys because this is way cooler. So these are the guys that are literally, they're parked here on the outskirts of the camp. They're the ones that are barking. So God kills some of these people for their complaining. Okay, so they're like, man, good night. How many times I'd be dead over in the car? Like, oh, thank you, Lord. Man, the rabble were among them. They had greedy desires and also said to the sons of Israel, and also the sons of Israel wept again, saying, who will give us meat to eat? Okay, where does the barking start? On the outside. Verse 4, the sons of Israel wept, saying, who will give us meat to eat? Where's the barking now? It's going like this. Right? And it's going to end up here. Want you guys to remember that. This is how complaining works. It sounds so innocent, and it sounds so simple. It's a couple people saying, man, you remember in Egypt, we had leeks and onions? We got nothing here. This sucks. Where's your God that did all these miracles? God, can you feed us, right? And all of a sudden, this cancer begins to spread amongst all the people. And the people that weren't originally discontent, certainly leaned that way, they barked plenty as it is, this is where it starts. And that complaining moves to the center of the camp, okay? I want you to notice kind of Moses' response, okay? And this is what these people were barking about, first of all, in verse 5. We remember the fish, which we used to eat free in Egypt. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our appetite is gone and there's nothing to eat except for this manna. You guys remember the manna? These little crackers with no taste. Like, yeah, they do the job, but man, I think Sean called them MREs. Like, they're nasty. They get it done, but they are not pleasant, okay? There's nothing except for manna. It talks about manna in verse 7, more of what it was like. That's all we have. Verse 10, Moses hears about the complaining throughout the families, each man at the doorway of his tent. The anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was displeased. Moses says to the Lord, listen to this. Listen to what complaining does to the leadership. Troy, read that in 11, since you've checked back in.
Now the rabble, there was
11:11, I'm sorry.
11:11?
Yes, please.
Moses said to the Lord, why have you dealt ill with your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people?
How does that feel as you're a leader and everybody's doing this? Why have you put this burden of all these people on me? Now, this sounds like Moses is doing one of these. Oh, God, it's so hard. This is legit. I want you to listen to him. Keep going.
Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child, the land that you swore to give their fathers?
You ever seen like poor like newborn dogs or cats that are nursing their young? These poor moms, it's just like you've got babies hanging all over them. And you realize without that mom, all these kittens or dogs are dead. Like they're really cute. But for a mom, it's like, man, this is a bit taxing. This is a bit of a burden. Moses is saying, I got 6 million people breastfeeding on me right now. Like this, I'm like a nursing mother to the, they're all babies. They whine and gimme, 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 gimme. And how does that feel? Feels like a burden. He's whipped by it, right? Keep going.
Where am I to get meat to give to all this people? For they weep before me and say, give us meat that we may eat. I'm not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me.
So he's saying, Lord, I'm about to crack. In fact, look at verse 15. Keep going.
If you will treat me like this, kill me at once. If I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my riches.
Like, God, I'm about to do something. I'm about to lose it. I'm about to lose my junk. It would be preferable if I found favor in your sight that you would kill me so that I don't have to go crazy on these people, because I don't know how I'm about to respond right now. Moses is at the breaking point. We've already been here with Moses, right? He had about a nervous breakdown coming out of Egypt. Jethro's like, bro, sit down. Come into my tent. Let's talk. Okay, Moses, you're going to need to get some help. You're going to wear out the people. You're going to wear out yourself. Get some leaders who can help have these discussions. And but bro, Moses is here again. Like, he is done with the people. And the imagery is really powerful. Like, am I their mother? Like, do I have to carry them in my womb? My goodness, Lord. Like, just kill me. Not kill the people. Kill me. So again, you see Moses' maturity in the midst of this. He's like, can you just, man, Joshua's great, God. You should have a look at him, right? But I'm kind of done. Okay, so please kill me. God says to him in verse 16, get a team. Moses, get 70 men from the elders who will be able to do this with you. Then verse 17, I will come down and I will talk to the people and they shall bear the burden with you. So 17, these guys are going to help. Verse 18, say to the people, consecrate yourselves tomorrow and you shall have meat to eat. You want to bark about meat? You like meat? God says, I'll give you meat. You're going to like this a whole lot. Oh, that we would have meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt. That's what you think? You think you're well off in Egypt? You think you ate meat for free? You were slaves. You didn't eat it for free, but that's your perspective. You want meat, I'll give you meat. Here you go. Not verse 19, for a day or 2 days or 5 days or 10 days or 20 days, but a month until it comes out of your nostrils. I had a buddy, so funny, one guy that went through residency like year two. He decided he and his buddy were going to sneak one of his grandmother's cigarettes, right? So he gets into his grandmother's purse, grabs a Marlboro, smokes it down, and then realizes, man, his grandmother's like OCD about how many cigarettes she has. So in order to not miss anything in the pack, he and his buddies, like a self-inflicted punishment, decide to smoke the entire pack of cigarettes. So they smoke the whole pack between them, right? He never smoked a cigarette again a day in his life. So it was like a self-inflicted like punishment. But that's what God's saying. You want meat? I'm going to give you so much meat, it's literally going to come out of your nostrils. And it's out of this rebellious spirit. Like, you don't think I can provide? This is amazing. Moses says, man, Lord, are you sure? Have you counted the people? By the way, verse 21, there's 600,000 dudes. How are you going to feed them? Like, how are you going to do this, Lord? Are you sure? Like, God's like, I'm sorry. Did you miss all the plagues? Did you see what I did in Egypt? Do you think I'm going to have a problem giving a buffet to these guys? Of course I can do it, right? God says to him in verse 23, is my power limited? Am I somehow not able to do this? I spoke the world into existence, Moses. Yes, I think I can take care of dinner. So Here's the story. God basically delivers meat to the people, gives them this gigantic buffet in chapter 11. There's a couple men in the midst of this, the rest of the story in 26 and following that are part of the 70 that don't come out. And Joshua and Moses kind of have a back and forth. It's kind of a side story. But Moses is basically saying, man, let's get these guys that God told me to get in the previous verses. And now in verse 31, God brings quail from the sea, okay, from the Mediterranean Sea, all the way down from the Sinai Peninsula. This is backwards, right? This does not happen. And he brings, listen to this, in verse 31, all around the camp, about 2 cubits deep on the surface of the earth. So from the ground up, 3 feet full of quail all around the camp, okay? And they went out and just started gathering quail. All day, all night, verse 32, they gathered quail. You get the amount basically in verse 32. I don't know what an omer is, but they had a ton of quail. 33, listen to this. While the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. So it was there just mowing on this buffet. Because you wanted meat, I'll give you meat. God gave it to him and said, are you sure that's what you want? And then literally a outbreak of like a plague comes on the people that it looks like kills some and puts others outside the camp. And God basically deals with their hardness of heart by giving them exactly what they asked for. You like cigarettes? Smoke the whole pack. And then why don't you tell me after that if you still like cigarettes, right? That's kind of the concept. So 11 is an interesting verse, and it's all about this idea of the barking that occurs outside the camp that's going to fester in the camp. And in chapter 12, we're going to see this festering, complaining attitude at the very heart and center of the camp. And it's going to come from Miriam and Aaron. Fascinating. Because it started here, and it gave them license, if you will, to bark and complain as well. Okay, so we'll pick up on that next week. Okay, so you guys enjoy.
Next year,
that's right. We will continue in 2017 in this text. So, all right, you guys enjoy your break. Hey, just be mindful. My bride's going in for surgery, so as you guys are studying, our surgical appointment is Friday morning at 5:30. So, man, just pray for us if you don't mind. We would sure cover your prayers. It's kind of a big deal. So, I'll be down in LA this week with my girl. So,
can we pray now?
Love for you too. Thanks, man.
Father, thank you so much, Lord, for Michelle and Mike, Lord, and Lord, how much time they put into helping us grow, Lord, and I pray, God, that you would bless them, Lord, because they have been such a blessing to us, and that you would just protect them on the way down there and also through the surgery, and keep the girls in good spirits, knowing that you're going to protect them and watch out for their parents. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. Her back. She's got a balloon disc. Hello. I'll find this one.